Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, some conversations with Dan Demers, the new executive artistic director and the director of Funny Girl at Hill Barn Theater, with Desdemona Chiang, director of Rapture Blister Burn at the Aurora Theater, and with the new music director of Opera San Jose, Joseph Marchesio. We'll talk about their production of Rigoletto. Plus, Diane Keogh will stop by with an update on other cultural activities down on the peninsula. Stay with us. The Aurora Theater Company presents the Bay Area premiere of Rapture Blister Burn by Gina Gianfrido, directed by Desdemona Chiang. It's a play that was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in Drama. Playwright Gianfrido has also written and produced for television for Law & Order, Cold Case, The Borgias, and House of Cards. Rapture Blister Burn opens this weekend with a run through September 24th. Here to talk about the play is its director, Desdemona Chiang, who is based both here in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Seattle. She makes her directing debut at the Aurora Theater Company with this play. With a name like Desdemona, she must have some Shakespearean credits, you think? Well, they include directing at Oregon Shakespeare Festival and California Shakespeare Theater, as well as directing works at Arizona Theater Company, the Mark Taper Forum, Magic Theater, Theater Works, among many others. Desdemona is a Cal grad. Welcome to Open Air, Desdemona.
Thank you for having me.
We've got to talk about your family history then, Desdemona Chiang. There must be some drama involved in their family.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My mother grew up in, this is actually an interesting story I tell to a few friends. My mother grew up in Taiwan, which is where I was born, and she grew up in the 60s there, and the education system, I think, was a kind of government a government-run system where you didn't really apply to college. You had to take a standardized test, and you were essentially assigned a college to go to. And so you were essentially, you went to a certain school based on whatever score you got. So the top 5% went to engineering school or then business school, and so all the way down. And so my mother took the standardized test when she was in high school and ended up scoring at the bottom 5%. Okay. And the government sent her to theater school. Which is really interesting. And so she ended up getting a Bachelor of Arts degree at the National Theater School in Taiwan and did Othello her senior year of college.
Oh, wow.
Which is how I got the name Desdemona.
Other Shakespearean characters in your family? Or?
I have a half-brother named Julius and a half-sister named Ophelia, believe it or not.
Fantastic.
I'm not kidding.
Did that inspire you yourself to go into drama?
No, actually. I was actually advised to not go into the theater when I was very young. I was told to go to medicine.
Be a doctor, of course.
Absolutely. And so I went to Berkeley with the intent of, you know, pre-med and going down that path. And my first semester of my freshman year, I had to take an arts elective. And I thought, well, what's the easiest class I can take to get an A to get into medical school? And I saw this class called Intro to Acting. And I thought, well, shoot, no papers, no lecture. I just stand in a room and play all day. That sounds great. And I did that, and I was hooked. And so after that, I took more classes, and I have a double major in theater and biology from Cal.
Fantastic. And you're making the most of it. I'm doing quite a bit of directing all around the area. Mm-hmm. That's super. Now, reading about this play, I'm sorry I haven't caught it yet, it delves into the world of feminism and internet porn. Now, would edgy be a good description of this play?
I think so. Yeah, it's a fair assessment.
Tell us about it.
Well, the play is about a woman named Catherine, who is a rock star academic scholar, and she is 42 years old and at a point in her career or, you know, at a point in her life, rather, where her mother has just had a heart attack, and she is unmarried without children and wondering whether or not she made the right choice in life, if, you know, having pursued her career and her job and her aspirations, you know, and not pursuing the family path, marriage, children, if that was the right thing to do. know that she is, you know, confronted with loneliness for the rest of her life, with her mother being ill and her being in her mid-40s. I think it's a question that a lot of women deal with, choosing career, choosing family, and for some reason we never seem to be able to balance both, or we try, and there's always a question of how do we make both work? So the play deals with those issues and a lot of the hard questions that I think women are afraid to ask, or afraid to admit about the difficulties of being a mother and having a career.
And in different generations. There's three generations represented in the play as well.
Yeah, Catherine is in her 40s, and her mother, Alice, is in her 70s. And there's a third character named Avery Willard, who is a babysitter who lives nearby, and she's 21.
Gina Gianfrido, this was a Pulitzer contender back in 2013. She's obviously an intelligent writer. Does that translate well to the stage?
Yeah, the play, you know, it definitely deals with a lot of academic ideas. We talk about Schlafly, Phyllis Schlafly. We talk about Carol Glover. You know, there's a lot of academic conversation, but at the end of the day, you are looking at women who are talking about deeply personal issues. So it's more than just ideas. It actually is about life.
Well, for people who those names aren't as familiar with as other names like Schlafly, give us a little bit idea of how feminism is addressed in the play.
Yeah, well, the premise of the play is that Catherine is teaching a summer seminar about, the class is called The Fall of American Civilization, and she essentially talks about how feminism and feminism is related to, you know, popular culture and internet pornography and reality television, and how these things have essentially led to the demise of civilization in America. And one of the chapters in the class deals with Phyllis Schlafly, who was a figure who opposed the ERA and the women's movement back when it was, I think, in the 70s and the 80s when that was all happening. And so, you know, there are two sides of the issue, I guess, that get talked about. There are some women that are very pro Schlafly's perspective, which was, you know, women have a very distinct role in society, and that they are, you know, that... How do I phrase this in a way that's not going to get me in trouble? that she believed that women
had their place.
Yes, and the ERA was about getting equal rights, and she had argued, well, do we really want equal rights? Do we want to give up, you know, things like privilege in child support and privilege in alimony, and do we want to get drafted? These are the things that Schlafly believed in and really thought, well, maybe the ERA is not a good thing for women. And it's really controversial, I think. I think there's some women who believe that, well, the ERA would have been a great thing for us, and other women who think, well, Schlafly might have a point.
And a whole other generation of women who have taken the objectifying nature of porn and owned it.
Absolutely. Yeah, they talk
objectified
about...
Objectified it.
Right, like they talk about raunch feminism, which is all about reclaiming sexuality, reclaiming, you know, the objectification that if I choose it, it's not objectifying, it's a choice.
I was reading an interview with the playwright, and she was saying how that less than a generation ago, porn was basically sticky floored dank theaters and girly magazines, and now that the internet, it's just changed that fundamentally, and that some sort of societal fallout is bound to happen. Let me just quote her for a minute. She said, "To access it, you had to form a plan and actually interact with other humans. Today, the internet has made really hardcore porn accessible in private in seconds." And she says, "I'm fixated on the idea that there has to be major psychological, sociological fallout from that." So does the play get that far involved in her issues there or not?
It does to some degree. I mean, they do talk about how pornography used to be this, you know, this a shameful thing you did where you had to go into the video store. There's the back adult section only. And, you encounter the risk of meeting a school teacher or a neighbor. And there was a little bit of judgment around it. And nowadays, with the internet being what it is, it's kind of like open season, I guess. Anyone can make it. Anyone can be in it. And now I think the shame veil is being lifted around it. I personally don't think there's anything wrong with pornography, if I can admit that. And they talk about, you know, boundaries. What is appropriate for me may not be appropriate for you, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, porn is often depicted as being demonized as being denigrating to women but and objectifying them. And then there's a whole issue of gay porn as well, mm-hmm. which is a totally different thing in a lot yeah. of ways. There's objectifying in both realms of it.
Right.
But some of it is the sheer beauty of it.
So. Right. I mean, I guess you can ask, you know, who's making it, who's it for, and who's in it. I mean, it's a lot of what we do in theater. When we look at theater, you know, what kind of theater are we doing? Who's making it, who is it for, and what's it about, and who is it about? Mm-hmm. And I think if you can make a case in either way, you know, either way for women, if it's made by women, for women, about women, then it may not be as problematic. That's the question I have, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's Desdemona Chang. She's directing Rapture, Blister, Burn, a play by Gina Gianfrido. Now, does the play suggest any kind of a solution to this problem, or is it even presented as a problem?
I think it's presented more as a dividing issue. I don't know if there's a solution or a problem to be, you know, definitely not a solution, but it does, you know, show multiple sides of the situation. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the cast you're working with.
I'm working with a wonderful cast of actors. A few of them are Aurora regulars, and I have two new people coming to the company. Marilee Talkington, who's a San Francisco actress, she's playing the role of Catherine. Gabriel Marin is playing Don Harper, her ex-boyfriend with whom she's rekindling a relationship with. Rebecca Schweitzer plays Gwen, who is Don's wife, and Catherine's ex-roommate. It's like a lovely love triangle with the three of them. And those three are the Aurora veteran actors who've been in previous shows. We're very lucky to have two newcomers to the cast. Lillian Bogovic, who is a South Bay actress. She's done some musical theater around town there. And a new young actress I'm really excited about, Nicole Javier, who's new to the Bay Area. She's been here for about maybe a year, maybe 2 years, not sure. But I'm excited to have them both in the company as well.
Nice. Well, what would you like an audience to take away from the play? What's the takeaway?
Ooh. I think the important thing is that we acknowledge that it's not easy, I think, for women to have to wrestle with these questions. I think a lot of times there's a lot of shame around not being able to do everything. And I think that's the thing women carry, you know, because we wanted equality, we wanted a career, we wanted to do this. And anytime we indicate, you know, a model that's contrary to that, it means we can't do it, you know. And sometimes maybe it's not as easy as it looks. And I would just love to hear conversations around the issue.
Nice. Well, there's a healthy dose of humor in the play as well.
Yes. Gina's a fantastic writer. Her dialogue, just it's so organic and, you know, great to hear.
Nice. Well, I wish you a pleasant run. What's happening after this play for you?
I am back in Seattle after I open this play. I'm going to be working on Measure for Measure at Seattle Shakespeare Company. It's very exciting for me. And I'm teaching at Cornish College this fall.
Very nice. That's Desdemona Chiang. She's directing at the Aurora Theater, the production of Rapture, Blister, Burn. It's the Bay Area premiere by Gina Gianfrido, a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize in Drama. It's at the Aurora Theater, Aurora Theater, theatre.org on Addison Street in Berkeley. It runs the 29th through September 24th. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Qual più malvento muto d'accento e di pensiero, sempre un amabile leggiadro viso, in pianto in riso e menzognero. La donna immobile, qual più malvento muto. Pensier, di pensier, di pensier.
An appropriate segue, I think, La Donna e Mobile, Mario Lanza, women being violated in a different kind of way, and this opera San Jose production of Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi, for six performances, September 6th through the 21st, at the California Theater. For four of those six performances, the conductor Joseph Marchese will be behind the pit and the singers. Joseph is the incoming music director and principal conductor of Opera San Jose. For this season, he serves as principal conductor for Rigoletto, as well as the premiere of Mark Weiser's Where Angels Fear to Tread. Although coming in as music director, he has already conducted some 11 or so productions with Opera San Jose. He's also staff conductor and cover at the San Francisco Opera, and has worked on productions of Showboat, The Flying Dutchman, premieres of Jake Heggie's Moby Dick and John Adams' Nixon China, as well as the world premiere of Mark Adamo's The Gospel of Mary Magdalene, as well as Tobias Picker's Dolores Claiborne. He's also worked with the Washington National Opera and Opera Theater St. Louis, and was music director for several years of the Amato Opera in New York City. Maestro, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, new music director incoming to Opera San Jose in this title as music director and principal conductor. Also new this year, Larry Hancock, as of June 2014, as general manager. Some major passing of the baton and torch in many ways from longtime director and founder of the Opera San Jose, Irene Dallas.
Yes. Yes. It has because they were the founders. This has been the first change, so that is everything. That's a first is a process of figuring out how it works. There's no real mechanism for it, but given that, it was a pretty smooth transition, and it wasn't. I don't think premeditated that Irene and Doc would leave at the same time, but it turned out that way, and Larry's been there since the beginning, and I've been there for many seasons, so it's a mixture of old and new in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So are you and Larry now primarily planning well ahead now?
Yes. Well, this season is already underway. The next season is already planned and prepared for, and the season after that is maybe half planned at the moment. And there's a certain kind of system where certain operas become due, and that makes planning a little easier. You know you're going to do one or two operas, and then the other two you take a chance on or do something that is a little bit more exotic or closer to your own heart.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading a little bit about your background, in that you like to first prepare for an opera by reading the libretto, not even worrying about the music that's involved. Now, I didn't realize that this story comes from a Victor Hugo play. Now, did you go there as well, or just to the adapted libretto by Piave?
Oh, this opera isn't... I remember the period in which I became first obsessed about this opera, because I went chronologically from Mozart through Verdi and eventually beyond that, and I stopped at each opera along the way, and I remember the first experience I had with this opera is that I got a recording and I listened to the recording, and I was just obsessed over that. And so this was before the period in which I had a more rigorous preparation of reading things first and then listening to them, so I was very familiar with the opera by the time this was also the first opera I had ever conducted, so I have that relationship with it. However, because it had a lot of interference at the time with the censors from the play, in which the Duke was actually the King of France, and a lot of things that had to be changed for political reasons.
Well, let's back up a step here.
Sure.
For a moment, because for the reality of radio, and that is that we can't assume everyone knows the story of Rigoletto. So how about a Cliff Notes version as you're talking about some of the historical background there?
Okay, well, Rigoletto is a hunchback who, partially because he's a hunchback and that has kind of limited his job opportunities, especially in the 1600s, he has become a jester. And he's a jester in the opera for the Duke of Mantua. In the original story, he was a jester for the King of France. And because he lives in a world in which he is viewed as ugly, and he is surrounded by people behaving uglily. He is kind of an MC of licentiousness in the court. He inspires everyone's worst instincts, and he really bathes himself in this kind of depraved environment. But he also has a daughter from the one woman who loved him and who dies before the story begins. And as a contrast to that, he keeps her completely cloistered in their home with no interaction anywhere except for the church. And what happens is she, in her trips to the church, meets this man who she doesn't know, who says he's a poor student, when in fact he is the employer of Rigoletto, the Duke. And out of malice towards Rigoletto, the courtiers of the Duke steal his daughter, who they think is his girlfriend, and bring her to the Duke, and he has his way with her. And when he finds that this has happened and that his whole life now has been ruined and she has been ruined, he hires a hitman to kill the Duke. But in that effort, his daughter, Gilda, finds out that this is what's going on and sacrifices herself instead. And at the very end, when the hitman brings the body, he opens the sack, finds out that it's his daughter, and recognizes that his life is over.
The very definition of operatic plot.
Indeed.
My goodness.
In fact, what I should mention, another, it's a very plot-heavy story, but in the first scene, when Rigoletto is behaving at his worst, the father of another daughter comes in, and he mocks him. Monterone is his name. And at the end of that scene, he curses him. He curses him from the perspective of a father. And the original title of the opera was supposed to be The Curse, because at the end he recognizes that this man's curse has been fulfilled, even though it was his own actions that ultimately fulfilled it.
Mm. Now you were mentioning how you became obsessed with this opera early on, and you learned a lot of the historical, the blocks that were put up by...
The censors.
And yeah, was that more for the portrayal of Italian nobility than it was for the violence that was going on?
Yes, I mean, there were a lot. There are things about hunchbacks and things that they thought maybe appear grotesque, but it was mostly because the play, which was also heavily censored and banned, showed the King of France and the court to be a bunch of lecherous, amoral, real unsavory characters, let's say. And anything that had any intimation of class resentment or class revolt was severely limited in that ability to be expressed. And so they moved it to Mantua, where there was no current duke anymore. So there was no one to be offended. There was no nobility to it. It had been dormant. I think it was the Gonzagas that were the last. And they did have a reputation for real libertinism. And so they tried, and there were many fights along the way, from even lines of dialogue to plot points about how much this could stay the original story. And to go back to your initial question of going to those sources, when Brad Dalton, who's the director, he read those original sources, and there was a lot of time spent debating about how much can we change because... We knew that Verdi originally wanted to do it this way, and it was only because of the censors that it was changed. And how much? And so the original text was a lot of a guide about how to portray it and interpret it in a way that kept a lot of the original material.
Did you read the original Victor Hugo?
I read transcriptions of it in English, and the critical edition of the opera has many. Points that references the original version. So you kind of have to go back to a lot of the original scenes and descriptions. So a good amount. Not every part of the original is in the opera, but yeah, the relevant lines and scenes I did. Yeah.
You mentioned that you were exposed to this opera at a fairly early age. How were you first exposed to Verdi's Rigoletto, and what was it that hooked you on it?
The first thing that I remember really going crazy about was the trio in the last act and the storm that at that time, because I really had only, I started with the operas of Mozart at the end of elementary school, and I did not listen to anything more advanced than the opera that I was at. I would go chronologically by composer, so I never heard a lot of what was coming up. I never heard any Wagner, I never heard any Puccini. So when I first got to that moment, that was the moment that really screamed out at me, and I thought was just the most amazing. I can remember hearing it the first time right now. I can remember that, the impression that it had on me.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that storm scene. I just pulled up a Met production from 1991. Let's have a listen. Just a touch of that storm scene and more of La Donna Mobile. Yeah, that was just, I remember that too, hearing that the first time, the quivering of the flutes and the thunderstorm and the groaning and the...
Yeah, they have an offstage chorus. They just wordlessly hum, like, no, 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 and it's quite an effect. I can't think of another opera that has that kind of imagination in the chorus music. And that also had a... I didn't even know what it was when I first heard the recording, and I was thinking, "What? How did they get that sound?" And of course, La Donna Mobile, which it's famous in certain circles that Verdi did not allow the tenor to have the music, and did not, and swore the orchestra to secrecy, and did not give it to them until a few days before the premiere, because he was convinced that it was become, as it was, extremely, extremely memorable and successful.
Wow, that's Joseph Marchesio conducting a Rigoletto with Opera San Jose from September 6th through September 21st. Congratulations on your new position as music director.
Thank you very much.
Once again. So let's talk a little bit about the staging that's going on. Are we going to see something traditional on this Opera San Jose stage, or have you moved it to a different place or time?
No, and it's an opera that does get a lot of treatment in different places and different times, and that's part of its... strength. There are a lot of operas that depend on the social milieu it was written about, but Rigoletto doesn't. Ours is not. Ours, I would say you could call it atmospherically period. It's the 1600s, but there are elements of it that are a little abstract, but yeah, it's definitely traditionally presented.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Hanscom and Evan Brummel will alternate in the role of Rigoletto.
Correct.
Isabella Ivey will be making her debut with Opera San Jose in the role of Gilda.
Yes.
Tenor Kirk Doherty debuts as a member of the resident ensemble in the role of the Duke of Mantua. Now let's talk a little bit about how Opera San Jose does things a little bit differently, in that you have a core ensemble.
Yes, we have... up until this year, we had two sets of rotating casts, and this year we decided to have one set. It's hard enough to find someone who can sing four different roles in a season, and we often do roles that are very different from one another. But it's almost impossible to find then two sets of people who are able to spend the entire year So we have a set of residents who sing the principal roles in all of the operas, except with certain exceptions. We have a Rossini premiere coming, which is L'Italiana in Algeri. And a Rossini tenor is a unique instrument, and you have to get someone very specific for that.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But otherwise...
For the patter.
Yeah, I mean, it's... And the stratospheric singing, and that role particularly was... Took a lot of time to find. But yeah, they come, they stay for the whole year, at least, and they sing every principal role. In cases like Rigoletto, which is a heavy sing, and we have a Saturday evening, Sunday matinee, there are times which we need to have two different people, because all the roles also are covered. So even if anyone is sick, we do have someone who will come in and be able to perform the role. But the larger roles, they get their own performances, and that's Evan, who has been a resident, and so it was an opera he really wanted to do, and it was the best fit. So he's alternating on that one. But for all the other operas, there's one cast for the entire run, and they stay for the year, and they sing, they do outreaches, they do concerts, and they do all our main stage shows.
Very nice. So now in this new capacity as music director and principal conductor, are you going to be able to add some of your wish list operas to the repertoire? Is there something that you really want to accomplish, either here at Opera San Jose or elsewhere?
I have a little esoteric taste, so I have to appreciate that and recognize that people may not flock to the theaters to see the kinds of things that I would really love doing. I, you know, as you mentioned, I work also in San Francisco. I work on a lot of new operas. I see that a lot of these new operas are not amazingly well attended, and people often don't share my enthusiasm. So I guess the hat you put on is the hat of responsibility, and you take the ones that you can when you think that they are the most appropriate, or you have the people that would do it to its extreme credit, or you have a season in which everything is such a super war horse that sells itself that you think, okay, we'll take a chance. But the people who come into this business are people who are passionate about their own operas. So a bunch of us have a wish list, and finding who goes in what slot is, I guess, what we're going to be doing for the future.
And it is all about balance.
It is diplomacy.
Yeah. Joseph, thank you for talking with us today. As Joseph Marchese, he's conducting Rigoletto, and we'll hear a lot more from him in the seasons to come in his new capacity as music director and principal conductor. We're going to hear the final fourth act quartet from Rigoletto to go out with. I'm wondering if you could set it up for our listeners.
All right. This, another extremely famous moment and considered an archetypical example of Italian opera, its ability to portray four different roles. There's Gilda, the daughter of Rigoletto, who is seeing the Duke behave amorously towards another woman. Rigoletto is bringing her to this tavern to try and disabuse her of the notion that this guy is really in love with her, and that he just is a libertine and he behaves this way all the time. And he's going to bring Gilda to spy on him, with this, with Maddalena, this girl that he's hanging out with now, and the hitman that he secretly hired, because this is all a trap of Rigoletto. He's trapped the Duke into this too, because he knew he would hit on this girl, and that her brother was going to murder him, and he used this opportunity to have Gilda watch how he acts, so that she would get rid of the notion that he had any love for her, and to just remove herself from this situation and let him do what he needs to do. So she's watching it. She's very distraught that the Duke is behaving this way. Rigoletto is telling her, look at this. This is what you have to know. And then at the same time, the Duke and Maddalena are having this kind of amorous interaction.
Music of Giuseppe Verdi from Rigoletto, the fourth act quartet. Le mie pene consolar. Gianni Pavarotti, June Anderson, Florence Kuvar, and Cheryl Milnes from that 2008 live performance of Rigoletto. You can catch Rigoletto by Opera San Jose down at the California Theater on South 1st Street in San Jose, September 6th through the 21st for six performances under the direction of my guest, Joseph Marchesio. Information at operasj.org. Still to come, some activities that will be going on at Peninsula Way, along with some operatic music of a different sort.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? How much my band out, I'll beat my drum. And if I'm found out, your turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat. Tulsa. I guess I didn't make it, but whether on the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once only, can die once bright, sir.
Don't Rain on My Parade, Barbara Streisand portraying Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl, one of Broadway's musical theater cornerstones that will kick off the 2014-15 season of the Hillbarn Theater, the peninsula's premier community theater company. Funny Girl and the partially fictionalized rags-to-riches story of Fanny Bryce, one of the most celebrated vaudeville entertainers that ever was. The executive artistic director of the Hillbarn, Daniel Demers, joins me in studio. The San Francisco native, San Mateo native, was recently named to this position this past June and brings a wealth of experience to his artistic directorship. Recently, Dan was seen on the Hillbarn stage as Max Bialystock in The Producers and briefly as King Arthur in Spamalot. That must have been a lot of fun. Dan, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So how did you pick Funny Girl to start things off?
We're calling the season of awakening, and I kind of wanted to explore this notion of self-identity and, you know, the human experience and what that means, and what better than the story of Fanny Bryce, the story of rags to riches and a woman who fights the face of adversity and everyone telling her what she can't do, and then she turns around and does it.
Well, the iconic role, of course, was Barbara Streisand.
Yes,
is it hard to divorce? Is the actor you've gotten as Fanny Bryce, is it hard to divorce that from that such an iconic production?
Yes. So Melissa Wolfclane, who's a Foster City local, she's in New York. She came back out to do the show. She's wonderful. We kind of set up a rule where we weren't going to talk about the movie. We were going to just take the show for what it was and really create the true story of Fanny Bryce, and in our own interpretation. And she's just doing a stellar job. She's a phenomenal comedian.
Mm-hmm. So does Hello Gorgeous fit into the show or
sure
not?
Sure does.
It does, okay.
Sure does.
So talk about the accompaniment of this production. Is it a full pit that's going to be accompanied?
Yes, it's I don't know what you would call it, a 19-instrument piece orchestra.
Sure.
There we go.
Yeah,
so it's a wonderful group of people. We are actually going to be doing the Sitz Probe this evening, which is the first time that the orchestra and the actors come together.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a real magical experience. There's 19 musicians.
And then lots of notes.
Yeah, pages and pages, copious pages of notes.
Stay for the notes, people.
Yes, nobody leaves. Yeah.
So talk about the rest of the batch. We mentioned Melissa Wolfclane as Fanny Bryce. Who else we have in the cast?
So we've got Will Giamona. He's playing Nick Arnstein. He's a phenomenal actor. He's been all over the peninsula and in the city. He's done some shows at NCTC as well. He's just a wonderful actor. He's got a beautiful voice. And he makes really strong choices in this show, and it's wonderful to see the two of them play off each other. We've got a comedic, you know, a strong comedic gal, Tracy Schiaponi. She's playing her Fanny Bryce's mother. She's just a force to be reckoned with. She was Lady of the Lake last year in our Spamalot, which was just phenomenal.
Well, for those who haven't been down to the Hillbarn, talk to me about the theater itself.
It's a beautiful, intimate theater. There's about 179 seats. It's a raked seating arrangement, so there's really no bad seat in the house, which, you know, you don't often get. But it's a beautiful space. It's unique. And one of the main things that we love is that anybody who comes to see our shows, you feel like you're a part of the show. Usually in a proscenium stage, you have that 40-foot rule where, you know, the first row is there just in range for spitting, right? So with ours, you really feel a part of the show. So everyone gets drenched equally.
You feel the spit.
Yeah.
You feel the love, you feel the spit.
Right? It's all part of the show.
Nice. Yeah. Information at hillbarntheater.org. Hillbarn Theater with an R-E dot O-R-G.
Yes, the old English way.
So you mentioned that the season is called A Season of Awakening in addition to Funny Girl production. sections of the 39 Steps in mid-October, mm-hmm. Irving Berlin's White Christmas for the holiday season, Amadeus in January, and Proof, as well as Curtains. Proof coming in March, Curtains in May. It's quite a season.
Yes, we're very excited about it.
How did this all come together under this title, A Season of Awakening?
Well, you know, going back to what we were talking about, this human experience and exploring what it means, you know, to take a path in your life and choose what you want to do. And you know, there's a quote that kind of inspired the season for me. It says, the two most important days in your life are the day that you're born and the day you find out why. And so that kind of fueled this season for me, because each show has these undertones of self-discovery and what it means to you know, define yourself and find what you want to do in life and what you want to, you know, accomplish in your life. So each show has elements of that for either the main character or a group of characters with each show.
Nice. So you are actually directing this opening production of Funny Girl. Is it more directing part of the season for you, or are you just going to sit back and do the executive work
need to do? Yes, I'm going to do the overview, the puppet master type thing for the rest of the season. But
But you've got a good crew of directors, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, it's one of the strongest groups we've had come through this company, and I'm really excited to offer these great shows to everybody.
And how are you moving the Hill Barn Theater forward? We just learned of the San Jose rep closing down.
Yes.
It's a tough time for some theaters, and others are really thriving.
So. Yeah. So it's, you know, that was a tough hit for all of us in the community. But what we are, the dream is that we are going to continue, you know, we're in a space where we keep growing and we keep, people love our product, and we, you know, the conservatory program, the kids are thriving and we're getting more and more kids every year. And so the dream is to really create a space on the peninsula that's a true artistic center of performing arts, where anybody at any age level can come and learn about the arts, enrich their lives, take classes, and really get immersed into the art world. And you know, and whether they want to do it for a profession or they just need an escape.
That's Dan Demers. He's directing Funny Girl, the opening season of the 14-15 season of the Hill Barn Theater, their Season of Awakening. The Hill Barn Theater is on East Hillsdale Boulevard in Foster City. Information at hillbarntheater.org. That's Hillbarn, theatre.org. The show opens tonight and runs through September 21st. I wish you a wonderful run, and let's have you back on to talk about some more of the season.
Yeah, I would love to. It's been great.
Let's go out with some more music from Funny Girl. Salonga from Carnegie Hall performance, singing Funny Girl, people from Funny Girl. You can hear that at the Hill Barn Theater. Information at hillbarntheater.org. Good afternoon, David Latulipe with you for Open Air. And one of our Open Air people is Diane Keough, back to talk to us about some more things that are happening down on the peninsula.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Welcome back.
Thanks. One of the things I want to say is that I was going to talk about Hill Barn later. It is a most fantastic venue. They do productions there that you would never believe could come out of such a small space. I'm looking forward to seeing this show and all the rest of the season, and I'm very pleased for Dan getting the promotion that he got. It's wonderful. So now I shall go on to what's playing right now, and will be playing for a short time anyway, and that's Dream Girls. Dreamgirls, you probably know, is the story of the aspirations for R&B acts like the Supremes, the Shirelles, James Brown, a whole bunch of others. And it charts their journey from being backup singers to stardom. And by the way, the play was originally on Broadway in 1981, from 1981 to 1985. So anyway, along the way, the story shows the problems that tear apart the groups, make enemies of best friends, and the way that records made it to the top 10 or number one on the charts due to the agents, managers, underhanded dealings with the DJs. And if you don't know what that is, it was known as payola. We don't hear much about it now, but we sure heard about it, about 20 years ago?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So at any rate, it has strong and clear voices, beautiful costumes, an interesting set, and makes the show very easy to remember. At the time of its inception, it was thought that the story was about the Supremes and Diana Ross, which, of course, it was. But the producers of the show said, oh, no, it's absolutely not. And therefore, they did not have any lawsuits, which I thought was kind of interesting. Anyway, you still have time to see Dreamgirls, the musical at the Fox Theater in Redwood City, through the 31st of August.
Information at BroadwayByTheBay.org.
Okay. I saw something last weekend, the opening of a show called Water by the Spoonful. It's from Theater Works. It's at Mountain View Center for Performing Arts. The authoress, I guess, or author, is Quiera Alegria Hudes, the author and Pulitzer Prize drama winner in 2013 for this particular play. It tells the intertwining story of a chat room for recovering substance abuse users and an Iraq veteran, Elliot, and his cousin Yasmin, a music teacher at Swarthmore. So that is the set for it. The story takes place in Philadelphia, San Diego, Japan, and Puerto Rico. And it's 6 years after Elliot has come back from Iraq. And the reason it sits there, because the chat room, the people are in all of these different places. They have wonderful chat room names that they come on with. And the four people in the chat room are Zila Mendoza as Haiku Mom with a secret, but who is 7 years clean and is the administrator of the chat room. Anna Ishida is orangutan, a young, brash Japanese-American girl adopted by an American family. She has taught English in Japan and wants to know more about her birth family and where she was born and why she was adopted. Anthony J. Haney has Chutes and Ladders. Great names these people chose for their names. He's an IRS investigator who's lost contact with his son and grandchildren due to his addiction. And Patrick Kelly Jones is Fountainhead. He's a well-to-do businessman who won't tell his wife about his problem because, according to him, he's only addicted on Saturdays. And yet he's in the chat room. So each one of them have their own personal demons. So we meet Elliot, who is Miles Gaston Villanueva, and Yasmin, Sabina Zuniga Varela, as they discuss their individual hopes and dreams. Elliot's working at a Subway shop, and he wants to be an actor. Yasmin is going through a divorce and still seeking she's not quite sure what. The dialogue for this excellent play is very slim and frequently uproariously funny, although you can't imagine that could be going on in a chat room with
substance
addicts.
Abusers, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're there because they have problems, but it is really, it's so beautifully written and it's so funny that people really just laughed and laughed out loud.
Well, 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Drama, not too shabby writing there, yeah.
Not too shabby at all.
And having its Bay Area premiere right now at Theater Works, Water by the Spoonful, Quiera Alegria Hudes, directed by Leslie Martinson. Information at theaterworks.org. That's theater with an R-E, theaterworks.org.
And it is playing until...
The 14th of September.
There's one thing I want to tell you about it. That's something we have seen in the past and we'll see much more of for all theater. And it's called projection, which we've seen in a lot of things. But in this case helps sets the stage for each act. So when they're on the chat line, you see their chat names and kind of the wiring back insides of computers. And then when they change it, it comes to something else at the very end. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a waterfall that seems to come down to the stage with a very quiet hint of sound. A magnificent play, well worth your time, beautifully written, and very much of today.
What else is happening down in the peninsula, Diane?
Well, we have right now we have I wanted to tell you about something else I saw with theater in mind, and that is I went to the New Works Festival at Theater Works, which is probably my eighth or ninth time for going. They've been doing it for 13 years now. They usually have five plays. A couple of them are musicals. We're not allowed not to talk about them, to review them. That's part of the thing that we say we won't do when we go. Because they haven't been finished. It's interesting because you'll go there and you'll sit through a play, and it's on book usually. And what will happen at the end of the play is they will give you a slip of paper with questions on it, and you fill in the answers to the questions that they ask about their play. They take them home that night, and the writers read them all and come back and two days later, probably maybe three, with the next version of it. Then it's done again and the next version of it. So it plays from the very beginning.
So workshopping.
To the very, but it's so interesting. So
you said you've gone for a number of years. Can you name a writer or two or works that have come out of this that have...
Memphis was one of them.
Wow.
A couple of others, and I've absolutely forgotten what they are. But I do recall that Alan and I used to go together. Because I introduced him to it because he hadn't been there before. So that made me kind of happy. We enjoyed it a lot. And anybody that goes to it will enjoy it a lot. It's only, I think, they $15 a ticket or something like that.
Right.
So it's not bad at all.
Mm-hmm. And on the art front, we just got a couple minutes to talk about real, museum-type art.
Yeah, museum-type art. And there's a lot to see at the Peninsula Museum of Art in Burlingame. The Institute Gallery, which is also there, has Dorian Heyman's acrylics and watercolors. But in the museum, there are four totally different artists. The first one is Tom Schultz, who does enormous, colorful, abstract paintings on canvas and some normal size, too. And then collages by Jerry Ann Linhart. Sculptures by Spiro Anagyros, the artist who is primarily known as the creator of the bust of former San Francisco Mayor George Moscone, which still graces the City Hall Rotunda, and the imposing 21-ton granite seal of the City and County of San Francisco atop the San Francisco Hall of Justice building, and the restoration of those neoclassical figures for the Palace of Fine Arts. Well, pieces here are slightly smaller, and they're much more intimate, but he is really a very well-known sculptor. He has there are a lot of heads there. There's a beautiful dolphin, and these are all done in bronze. And... In the early 1940s, there was something called collateral damage by Cosette Dudley, and this one is really very moving. In the early 1940s, Dudley had taken pictures of her friends with her Brownie box camera, like the one I had, and her friend Betty was in almost all of them. It seemed that one day, Betty was no longer there. Her home was boarded up, and she just was gone. So half a century later, Dudley created a series of photogravures which he titled Executive Order 9066, referring to the order that was put through about the Japanese. In these pictures, her friend Betty represents all of the Japanese girls and children that were relocated to camps. To their friends, one day they were there, the next day they were gone, as is Betty from Dudley's pictures. No words are necessary as you view the photos. Absolutely wonderful. Okay, one thing about what's coming, which is Wicked, is coming and starting tonight at the San Jose Center for Performing Arts. And what they usually do down there is they run a play from a Tuesday through a Sunday. This time they are running it from now until September 14th because it is so popular it usually sells out.
Popular. Well, you know, as a little tease of Wicked, we have popular at the ready. Now, this is based on the Gregory Maguire book, the author of the novels Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister. If you haven't read the book is an absolutely marvelous read. They obviously had to cut things down for the musical.
Yeah.
Just tell us where the musical is.
It's at San Jose Center for Performing Arts. It's a Nederlander production, so you've got that great cast that really knows what they're doing. And it's just incredible.
And with that, I'll thank you for your insight into all things Peninsula, Diane.
Thank you.
Popular. You're going to be popular. I'll teach you the proper poise when you talk to boys. Little ways to flirt and glance. I'll show you what shoes to wear, how to fix your hair, everything that really counts to be popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, cause you've got an awfully long way to go. Don't be offended by my frank analysis. analysis. Think of it as personality dialysis. Now that I've chosen to become a policist or an advisor, there's nobody wiser. Not when it comes to popular. I know about popular.
Get a touch of popular. You can catch that down on the peninsula. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air, our weekly cultural magazine. My thanks to producer Neil Swinkles for helping wax the works here to keep it going smoothly. If you've got an idea for a show suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. It's at our website that all of our shows are archived for your listening pleasure at your leisure. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. An hour of news from the BBC is next. Stay with us.